revolution. There's no connection with experiment. And so my attitude when I see the kind of conversations that have been going on among our quantum information, quantum foundation friends the last few years is great happiness to hear some of the same issues raised and discussed from a different point of view. Variable or indefinite causal structures are a complex of issues, of course, we're very familiar with. And relative locality, the idea that locality might be an observer-dependent effect, which has begun coming up in papers from your community, is something that we're very familiar with, from a different logic completely. And I'm giving this presentation, and I'm setting up Lingwen Chen, who will give further detail, and not so happy part of the story, perhaps. Well, I won't characterize your talk. She's looking at me like I'm already in trouble, so I didn't say that. Later. And my idea is to convey ideas, whatever wisdom, knowledge, results we have, and the puzzles that we have. So this is the first time I've ever given a talk on a work that's so old. So it was a great pleasure to go and remember it. And Laurent was a co-conspirator on most of this work. And Laurent, my impression looking back over the old papers is they're better than I thought they were. But we'll see. Laurent and I have each taken off from the conclusion, which I'll get to in very different directions, which perhaps we can speak about later. So there's blah, 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 which I'm going to skip. No.
No.
I'll say this is really should be the concluding slide, but it'll tell you, look, everybody in quantum gravity has a list of things they believe are fundamental and a list of other things they believe are derived. And so this is my list, and this work has been very influential in developing this list. And where it went for me was in the direction of what we call energetic causal sets that Marina Cortez and I developed, where we got additional things that we're committed to, like the reality, the fundamentality of time and the irreversibility of time. But space and time are emergent. Space-time is emergent. What is not emergent is causality and causation. If that seems contradictory to you, your intuition is too classical. What is fundamental is energy and momentum and causation. There is no geometry fundamentally except the geometry of momentum space. And we follow Einstein, who taught us that observers, as experimental physicists, we are basically calorimeters with clocks. We measure when we send out signals which carry certain amounts of energy and momentum, and we measure when those signals return to us on clocks. And we're very happy that some of you all want to make those clocks quantum, and we'll see where that ends up with us. So there is some quantum theory of gravity. 5 months from now, the world will be transformed by somebody, maybe one of you, coming up with the right theory. Let's assume that it's a quantum theory. It has, as far as we know, 4 fundamental constants, Newton's constant, h bar, the speed of light, the cosmological constant, and the emergency parameter. If you don't know what the emergency parameter is, you're hanging out with the wrong people, but come ask us. How do we make contact with experiment? Like most physicists, we in contact with experiment by making approximations and taking limits. So we know very well that if we take this theory, whatever it is, and take the limit h bar equals 0, we should get classical general relativity, which suggests that classical general relativity is a kind of emergent phenomenon that emerges in a limit. Now, we're going to study here a different limit, which led to a version of this is very much, I should emphasize, a phenomenological study. We isolated a group of phenomena that might appear in a different limit of the theory that had not been studied before. And that included what we call the relativity of locality. So what is that limit? We'll skip philosophy. So quantum gravity, we assume, depends on Newton's constant. I'm going to hold the speed of light fixed, which is not what you all do. We're going to ignore the cosmological constant, the emergency parameter, and we're going to parameterize it in terms of Newton's constant and the Planck mass, which is the square root of h bar over g. Now, general relativity is a limit of G held fixed and H bar to zero. So M Planck to zero, and that's what I show there. We then take G to zero, Newton's to zero, and we get special relativity. We got interested, and it's a funny story that has to do with some ideas that didn't turn out so well because some people found problems with them, which we can gossip about later. It's so much for doubly special relativity. We got wondering about taking those limits in the reverse order. So we take H bar to zero and G to zero, but we hold the Planck mass, which is the ratio fixed. We want you to contemplate that limit, C fixed as well. And that's what we call relative locality. It's a phenomenological description that depends on the speed of light and a fixed mass or energy, and not on H bar or G separately. Then we take M Planck to zero and we get back to special relativity. So it's some elaboration of special relativity. Okay? It's called relative locality. Now, okay. Now, in general relativity, look at the left-hand branch. You're used to thinking that the phase space of general relativity is space-time with the tangent space over points characterizing or quantifying the momenta of particles which live at those points. We're going to turn out to be interested in the opposite picture. Momentum space is fundamental, and space-times are tangent planes, really cotangent planes to space-time. What is the regime good for from a phenomenological point of view? Well, the Planck length has gone to zero, so there's no quantum geometry. But let me remind you what I said before. Operationally, as experimental physicists, we're calorimeters with clocks. And so we should think of what is affected if we're an astronomer. We describe space-time phenomenologically by receiving light signals of different energies. We coordinatize distant events by sending out light signals which bounce off those events coming back. What's changed if we have a new fundamental constant, M Planck? And what can we infer from that? And the only thing we have to play with, and think about it, we thought about long and hard, is the geometry of momentum space. So this scale is going to be a scale at which new physics is introduced, having to do with deforming the geometry of momentum space. And if you're brilliant at deduction, you can leave now and just take away that idea and work out its consequences. Now, we're used to thinking that space-time is fundamental and momenta are auxiliary variables for describing motion in space-time. But this is not what experimentalists do, and it's not what we're going to do. We take the opposite. So what happens, well, an important question to ask if we're phenomenologists is what happens to quantum symmetry? What happens to Lorentz invariance, the symmetries of the theory? And that turns out to be a question that we can probe observationally to order energy over Planck energy, or order energy over Planck energy squared. Now, I don't have time to give that part of the talk, but there's extensive work using high energy astrophysics to probe those approximations to quantum gravity. And that's what we built the mathematics that I'm about to describe to you to do. And if I have time, I'll come to one test, which is, comes from gamma ray bursts. I'll skip that now. Now, from dimensional analysis, I'm saying something really weird. You're used to thinking of quantum gravity as modifying short-distance physics, modifying physics at the Planck length. But we're in a regime where there is no Planck length. It's just a Planck energy. So why, even if we're interested in high energy something, are long distances relative? And the reason is that little red equation. We're interested in deviations from standard physics they're going to be parameterized by a delta x proportional to x times the low power of energy over the Planck energy. And that is where we find violations and relativizations of locality. That is the construction of a space-time as a local, universal, absolute object that we believe in is trashed, if you want to use the proper word, or transcended or distorted at those distance scales delta x, which happen to be, when you work them out, for delta x to be appreciable, say a centimeter, a second of light travel time, x has to be about 10 billion light years. So we're talking about very infrared phenomenon testing our most, what we're used to thinking about, the most ultraviolet theory. Like special relativity, there are paradoxes. These were first built, pointed out by Sabine Hassenfelder. The reaction to the paradoxes is to think more carefully and discover new experimental tests. So this work passed through a phase where we were very agitated and nervous, and our critics, and there were others as well, unwilling collaborators, kept saying, no, what you guys are doing is inconsistent, it's crazy. And we said, no, what we're doing is taking space-time as relative to the position and motion and energy of the probes or observers. Just like in special relativity, you no longer take space seriously, except as relative to observers. Here you only take space-time seriously as relative to observers. Why should the curvature of momentum space lead to issues with locality and space-time? That's what I'm going to tell you. Because space-time geometry is inferred from momentum space. And there's the standard way in which we believe what we can measure the world is local, where a calorimeter with a clock, and we construct space-time by our sending and receiving photons. Do we all infer the same space-time? Do we infer the same space-time at different energies? The answer is yes in special relativity, and no in the physics we'll be showing you. Why? The conservation laws in ordinary special relativity that generate transformations between observers are linear in the momentum. Therefore, the translations that are generated are independent of energy and momentum and anything else. But what if the transformation laws are nonlinear? What if the conserved charges, the conserved energy and momentum, are nonlinear? Do we still infer the same space-time? No, and here is the same calculation, putting in the top line nonlinear terms in momentum, just expanding out because we're phenomenologists. And that generates a translation which now is dependent on the energy and momentum carried by the world line of the particle that we're translating. That's already, again, we could stop here and that's enough to take the lesson away. Why? Because supposing you're talking about a distant event 10 billion light years away and two electrons glide locally and move away, and they could be very energetic electrons, let's say. Then a different observer is going to see those electrons interact without coming near each other, because relativity includes locality. And that's what we're going to be showing you how to represent. Okay, everybody with me? So that's what I said in words, and the name for this is the principle of relative locality, the way that we formulate it. And the question I have for you all, as you follow now, I'm going to show you how we describe this a little bit more mathematically, is how does this relate to your discovery of similar phenomena in Hilbert spaces with quantum reference frames and quantum clocks and stuff. So operationally, as calorimeters with clocks, we can make two kinds of measurements. Measurements on single particle states and measurements on multi-particle states involving interaction. Measurements on single particle states give you a study of the geometry, in particular the metric of momentum space. And I'll show you that. Measurements of collisions of relativistic particles give you constructions of connections on momentum space. So the geometry is very clear, and I'll just introduce you to it. And a lot of this was Laurent's work, and there's a lot more besides what I'm telling you. So when you measure the mass squared and check the mass squared is some function of p, you're measuring the metric on momentum space. So anything you can do to a single particle turns out to be a measurement on momentum space. Now, you can tell I've got more to say than I'm going through. I've got more on the slide in terms of details than I'm going through, but I hope you get the message. What about interactions? Well, in interactions, look at the top red line. We combine two momenta, K and Q, to make a new momenta, K prime. And that, we're going to say, is governed by some map, K plus circle plus Q. And on the curved momentum space, the possibly curved momentum space, we're adding two geodesics. K is a curve on the momentum space ending at a point. P is a curve ending at a point. And we're parallel transporting one curve against the other. And so there's a connection involved. And so on. I could give the details, they're on the slides if you want them. We assume that there's an inverse, but we don't assume anything else about this connection. And we find that different assumptions about the particle interactions leads you to different geometries. In particular, torsion measures non-commutivity. If it matters what order the particles come near each other, in some sense, if there's some labeling on which it matters, so if there's an anti-symmetric part of the scattering, that there's a non-commutivity, then that produces a torsion on momentum space. Associativity is tested by the curvature of momentum space. If the interaction is non-associative, that produces curvature on the momentum space. And finally, there is no reason why the connection given by the interaction should be compatible with the metric measured by the single particle inertial properties. So there can be non-metricity. And each of those three types of mathematical structures, types of curvatures, if you will, characterize different things that could happen in quantum gravity phenomenology. We're classifying the possible quantum gravity phenomenologies at this extreme limit where H bar and G are to zero, but we kept the ratio fixed. So if there are possibilities in that limit, there are more general possibilities in the quantum theory of gravity. Okay, that's why we find this interesting. Now, let's give a little model to study what kind of dynamics we have in hand. We're going to give an action principle. So we're going to be very conventional. And our action principle is going to be an action principle for motion on momentum space. We're going to do good with our blah, blah, blah claim that space-time is emergent, momentum and energy are fundamental, by giving you a dynamics defined in momentum space solely. And we'll see what role space-time emerges to have and how the properties of space-time are forced to be observer-dependent by the dynamics. So the action has a free part and an interacting part. And by the way, I very much appreciated the talk that went superluminal and turned things on the head and said that there wasn't, you couldn't give causal reasons for superluminal interactions to happen. But if we're honest, we never give reasons. I mean, in a Feynman diagram like that, if those are fundamental particles, there's not a little clock going click, 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 emit. We've got to give reasons, and we don't give reasons. And that's one of the things that we're trying to do in the energetic causal set program, is give reasons. And of course, we have to go beyond locality to give reasons for interactions to happen. The free relativistic particle action governs the free particle. There's a constraint, which is the energy-momentum relation, which is a constraint in momentum space, a constrained surface. There is a conjugate variable to momenta, which we call x, but it's not a coordinate in any manifold. It's just labeling the cotangent vectors of the momentum space. And we have equations of motion, which are much like the ones you've seen before, except C might be more complicated. Okay? The interesting stuff happens, well, it's, wow, I'm taking three slides to say that. The interesting stuff happens with the interaction. And here's something that occurred to us that we've not seen in a textbook, but maybe it is somewhere, because it's so obvious once you think of it. What generates local interactions in a relativistic particle model like this is a constraint that tells you that the momenta into the interaction are equal to the momenta coming out of the interaction. So the constraint is we have three or four in particles in and out, and the constraint, which we call K, is some function of those momenta ingoing and outgoing. For example, the one that I have there, K, O plus P, parentheses, O plus Q, equals zero. If those pluses were real linear additions, this would be standard relativistic particle physics. Now, that constraint is enforced by a Lorentz multiplier called Z. And let me tell you in words what happens when at the level of the equations of motion, and only at the level of the equations of motion. At the level of the equations of motion, that momentum conservation rule is imposed. Also is imposed equations that say that these x's, which are really cotangent labels for momentum space, are set equal to the z, which is the Lagrange multiplier for the constraint. And so the equations of motion, and since we're quantum physicists, I emphasize again, only the equations of motion tell you that the interaction is local. Now, when the conservation laws are nonlinear, those interactions, the equations of motion do not say the interactions are local. They say they're relatively local. And to understand what that means, you have to understand the difference between the x's, which are the conjugate variables to the momenta. Again, we're just in momentum space, and the z's, which enforce the conservation laws. And let's look first at the x's. The x's live, and their momentum space is in pink. In blue is a cotangent plane to momentum space. And that's where the x's live. But it's the cotangent plane over the momentum, k, of the particle. It's not, so different particles of different momenta, they have trajectories in different cotangent planes. There is not a universal space-time. The z's live in the cotangent plane of the origin because they represent a conservation law. and the equations of motion give you a connection on the momentum space, which allows you to move those curves, the z's, into the x's. But if the conservation laws are nonlinear, those parallel transports, those connections, are nonlinear. And you don't have, you're not allowed to just identify the different cotangent planes. But that's the mathematical phenomenon. Space-time has gone away, just like space has gone away in special relativity. And so this just said that with another chance in the picture. Now, the way that relative locality works is if you're an observer near where the conservation law is imposed at z equals zero, you see a local interaction because z is zero and that's linearly related to the x's through the connection. I'm sorry, not linearly related, but z equals zero enforces x equals zero. So they're all pile up on top of each other, and that's local physics that you've always believed in. If you're an observer distant from where the energy momentum conservation is imposed, you see genuinely that one world line comes to a screeching halt, another world line starts, another world line starts, all at points non-local to each other. And this is classical physics, so there are formulas which govern those intervals. But basically, this is necessary because momentum space is curved and the cotangent planes can't be isomorphically identified for different momenta, for trajectories of different momenta. There are some examples. Kappa-Poincaré is a well-studied example. A thing that I forgot to mention is that the z's are non-commutative. So that to the extent to which you can say, oh, I'll take that as the preferred, what I call space-time, it has non-commutative coordinates. Kappa-Poincaré is a very well-studied non-commutative geometry. And how much time will the chair give me? Okay, so let me describe very quickly one experiment, and then I'll be interested to discuss it. Maybe I'll say some things that I hope are inspiring at the end. So the gamma ray burst problem. Long ago and far away, there was a gamma ray burst, 10 billion light years away. Two photons were created simultaneously according to a local observer. One in the KeV range, the other maybe 80 JeV. They're very different energetically. And I'm telling you a real story. Are they detected by the Fermi satellite simultaneously? And can I use observations by the Fermi satellite and other satellites to test or measure the geometry of momentum space and see if you can measure its curvature or its non-metricity? For example. Now here's a dumb, I shouldn't say it's dumb because I published papers that did this until Laurent set me straight. Here's a wrong calculation. Wrong calculation is you can choose coordinates on the curved momentum space so that the dispersion relation makes it look like the speed of light is energy dependent. And then you can calculate that there's an energy dependence which affects these two photons, and there's a time difference when they arrive. Problem is that that's not invariant. You can also find coordinates on momentum space where the speed of light is identical, and there's no effect. And then you end up in mistaken arguments about who has the best set of coordinates, and so forth. Of course, the right answer is to do something invariantly, to compute something around a curve that closes, and so compute something invariant. So that's the strategy of the calculation. There's the atom in the gamma ray burst emitting two photons with the time difference s, and all the momenta are labeled and all the events are labeled. and labeled it, later there's an atom in the Fermi detector, which at events Z1 and Z4 detect the two photons with the time difference of S2. And basically, you have to compute this as a parallel transport of a loop in phase space, because there is no space-time, which is common to those detectors and atoms and photons. And I'm not going to take you through the details, although this was something Laurent and I did. And I felt, at least, this may have been easy for Laurent, but I felt pride to get to the end. And there's the end in the red box. The time difference is proportional to the energy of the photon times an overall average time times components of the connection that turn out to code into the non-metricity. So this is a measurement of the non-metricity of momentum space, and it is relativistic. That is to say, the observer at the gamma ray burst thinks they were emitted simultaneously, and that there's a problem with locality in the observations that we make over here on Earth. And we think on Earth that every interaction involved in this detection was local, and there was a non-locality in the emission. But when we compute an invariant quantity, we all get the same answer. And the answer is that the value of the non-metricity tensor, given observations that were current 10 years ago, is 1 over 0.6 M Planck. So that's impressive. We're bounding phenomena at the Planck scale. Unfortunately, we're not detecting it. And even more unfortunately, super-duper photons like the one that gave rise to that measurement ceased about then to be common coming from the Fermi satellite. Okay, so that's my basic message. There are other phenomena we discovered, like a kind of dual gravitational lensing. If there were more time, there would be a lot more to discuss. And I'll stop on my conclusions. But let me just sort of say a hope. Somebody is telling me I've gone on too long. This is very phenomenological, the way I described it. A number of people, Laurent and some of the people he's working with, have taken these ideas as foundational for inventing a new fundamental physics. And there's a lot to say for over 10 years of work from that direction. I started with a different program, but very much the next step of this, with Marina Cortez, in which we got very interested in the issue of time reversibility and the fundamental nature of time and the question that you're addressing here of whether causation is something which is fundamental or something which is emergent from some kind of fundamental world you describe without causation. And that was, we understood the stakes 10 years ago, and it's still the stakes. So thank you very much.
So when you say that distance is being non-constant, even though local observer sees it's being constant,
yes.
Do you mean that particles coming from there arrive at different times, or is it something else?
I mean exactly what the picture said. In two particles in and two particles out, there are four straight whorl lines, one going into the collision, one going out, one going in, the other going in, the two going out. Consider these four whorl lines. They each have different energy, momentum. When you translate them 10 billion light years, they each get translated by a different four vector so that they merely end and begin. It looks like the kind of thing that we were told in all of our training was ridiculous, but that's what happens, and it's because momentum space is curved and the different four different word lines don't live in the same space. They each live in a different cotangent space of the tangent bundle over the curved momentum space.
I'm looking for an operational meaning, and maybe you just gave that. I didn't understand it.
So the operational meaning comes down to the detectors click at different times.
You made this remark that you can only say something about locality when you look at the level of equation of motion rather than the action.
Yes.
I would imagine, like, can I not write down an action and say this is a local, describing a local interaction at the level of an?
Well, I hear, I'm going to just be polemical, because the answer is you might be able to. But I've heard a lot, it was and from different talks, including, I think, yours, about the utility of constrained dynamics. Of course, what has been the bend brother for us for years, the importance of, if you want to be relativistic and relational, representing dynamics in terms of first-class constraints. And I personally, after working on that kind of research program, much of my life have severe doubts about it, but it sounds like there are people in this room who don't, in quotes to be polemical, yet have serious doubts about that. And as long as that's your blueprint for quantization, I've done it right. I presented the classical mechanics in a form which is entirely in terms of first-class constraint dynamics, including the locality. That's, and I'd be very interested if somebody has seen that somewhere else, the notion that the locality is embodied in a conservation law which is imposed as a constraint.
Any more questions?
So you start with taking momentum space as fundamental. I wonder whether this is a fundamental choice, whether so. And people start with, say, the coordinate space as fundamental and come up with a same theory. It's just different mathematical expression. Or is there some fundamental reason that prefers momentum space?
I think there are several things that lead to it. But let me draw a little bit wider picture, because this is not the only thing that's gone into my thinking that momentum and energy are fundamental. Let me discuss... Well, two different points of view. One of them is the whole experience with causal sets. The original causal set program posits that all there is in nature are events in their causal relations. And you're supposed to discover that everything else is emergent, including space, time, and energy, and momentum, and conserved quantities. And it's a very brave program, and it's occupied the lifetime of some of my dearest friends, who I most respect. And I'm sorry they're not here, but they know to defend it from what I'm about to say, but they know what I think, which is that it's failed. That is, there's no emergence of anything, because the generic partially ordered set looks nothing like a sprinkling of a causal set of a low-dimensional Lorentzian manifold. So we, with Marina, tried a different kind of causal set model where we imposed that energy and momentum are fundamental and are transferred by the causal relations and conserved at the events. And through something which I can show you, but it's not dissimilar, except in one important way, from the equations that I was showing you, we found that space-time was genuinely emergent.
Genuinely
emergent. In the philosophers, and I've just been in a philosophers' conference, talk about different kinds and different degrees of emergence. And I mean old-fashioned, weak, type 1A emergence. What's not there in the fundamental formulation, it emerges at the level of the equations of motion in certain conditions. So that's one thing. That is, there's a suggestion that space and time on the one hand, and energy and momentum are deeply related to each other, of course, through the canonical commutation relations, through Noether's theorem. Noether's theorem says if you have a symmetry in space, then you generate a conserved quantity. So that suggests that space is more fundamental. But there's a but to that, which is that in general relativity, there are no conserved quantities. There are no global conserved quantities when you don't have an asymptotic or boundary region. That's a theorem of Karol Kukoc. There's a whole blah, blah, blah from philosophy about the identity of the indiscernible, which says that you can't have symmetries, global symmetries, in a fundamental theory. But then you would have two solutions that are mathematically distinct that are indistinguishable. So the root of positions and points and times are fundamental, and energy and momentum are emergent, doesn't seem to me to have been doing very well. So we try the reverse and we get some results that make us feel confident. Yeah. Laurent?
Yeah, can I add something on that?
Please.
One reason why you think momentum is more, energy momentum is more fundamental than the point, the position, it's an operational definition. If you get it microscopically, the things you really measure directly are energy and momentum. Nobody ever measures the moment in time or point in space. And the reason these are the things that you really measure is because they are associated to conserved charges. That is, isolated system preserve energy and momentum. In gravity, we understand that there's no global notion of energy and momentum, but there's quasi-local notion of energy and momentum. So these are like the prime quantum elements. Now, from that perspective, if you really take an operational point of view, that the only thing that you have access to are energy and momentum, from that perspective, position space is a very complicated object. It appears as a superposition of a lot of different energy and momentum. And now if you change a little bit what you call energy and momentum, let's say if the rule of addition of energy and momentum is a bit modified by gravity interaction, then you will have to modify the way you define position. So position is a very complex object, microscopically. Of course, you know, in our world, we don't measure on the X because we have coarse grain the system. So in the infrared, you know, the infrared is not the fundamental picture. So in the UV, the fundamental observer is the energy and momentum, and position is a very delicate object. That's
cool. Well, with that, I think we did.
Thank you very much.